Today in Studio 360, The Nightmare Next Door. In the terrific new movie Miss Bala, a young woman enters a beauty pageant and then finds herself in the middle of Mexico's drug war.
Even if you are good, there is no way you can rebel against this power.
I'll talk with the film's director about how he made a movie about the cartels, Among the Cartels. No. And later in the show, you could sit comfortably at home writing music, or you could paddle down the big, cold, scary Mississippi River in a kayak. For Eve Beglerian, the choice was obvious.
There is this sense that there is a line, and you, by getting on the river, are following a line.
She'll perform some of those Mississippi River songs live. Plus, we know China can make our TVs, but can they fill them with content we actually want to watch? All that and more is ahead today, right after this.
You're listening to the podcast of Studio 360 from Public Radio International and WNYC, where each week Kurt Anderson brings you great stories and conversation about creativity, pop culture, and the arts. We have a great website, too. Visit studio360.org to find out more.
Studio 360 is supported by Scion. Scion, making vehicles for today's connected youth and offering over 150 accessories to choose from. Learn more at scion.com. Scion, what moves you?
This is Studio 360. I'm Kurt Anderson. Today on the show, we'll hear from one of the greatest jazz drummers of all time, Jack DeJohnette.
It hit me clearly, like a bolt of lightning, like, oh, drums is what I'm going to do.
But to start the show, we all know about China's turbocharged economy, growing several times as fast as ours. President Obama devoted a pugnacious chunk of his State of the Union to it last week. But when it comes to the global culture war for hearts and minds, the U.S. is still the unrivaled superpower. For now. Last month, China's president announced that the government was investing heavily in homegrown but exportable culture. But then, just days later, the government shut down two-thirds of its domestic satellite television shows for being too popular.
In many ways, they envy what the U.S. has. Every time we sell movies or television or books or, most importantly, news content to the rest of the world, we suddenly get out American ideas and values.
Carlos Tejada is the Wall Street Journal's China news editor based in Beijing. He says the biggest obstacle to spreading Chinese culture around the world is probably China itself.
Culture is ultimately the clashing and then the adoption of new ideas. And the Chinese government's control of the media is simply opposed to that. They're not allowing the sort of clash of ideas that makes American culture sort of interesting, but then ultimately addictive to the rest of the world.
Well, in addition, I mean, sometimes I'll be watching television here in New York City and see some product of the state media enterprise promoting Chinese tourism or whatever. They just often don't seem to have modern media techniques down very well.
Well, yeah, let's talk about that for a second. Much of what China is doing there is trying to protect its national broadcaster. Every Lunar New Year, there's a five-hour special called the Spring Gala, and it's one of the most boring things I've ever seen. It's really terrible. There's singing. There's a lot of cameras focusing on important people in the audience. It's really a snooze fest. At the same time, there's a broadcaster, I believe it's the Hunan Satellite Television. Its Spring Gala Festival had Shaquille O'Neal dressed up as Shazam doing some kung fu fighting with some small children. You know, entertaining and funny, and that's exactly what the central government doesn't want.
Yeah.
Eyeballs looking away from the national broadcaster.
Actually, one of our contributors in Beijing attended this year's Spring Gala and talked to a producer named Shitao, who rejects the idea of imposing Chinese culture on other countries and says that next year he wants to invite Lady Gaga because that's what'll get him high ratings.
I think we need to make our program more international. I think if we have domestic and foreign acts, if we produce the gala in New York City or San Francisco, We'll bring over Chinese stars and have them perform with the local superstars who live there. Then American broadcasters will buy it.
Did you try to do that?
I think I want to try next year.
So is it just a matter of time before China capitulates and gives in to the West as far as culture goes?
You know, that's a good question. I mean, at the same time that these sort of state broadcasters are trying to muddle their way and largely failing at developing culture, you have a very thriving culture on the internet.
Yes,
here.
Yes.
And the challenge for the Chinese government is, how do you control it without killing it?
Right.
You know, a great example of the Chinese kind of ham-fisted way of getting its culture out is the recent Christian Bale movie, Flowers of War. This is about the rape of Nanjing in the late 1930s.
It was December 13th, 1937, and Nanjing was on fire.
The film industry really got behind this, and this was the movie that they submitted to the Academy Awards as China's submission for best foreign film. It didn't make even the first cut.
Stop! This is a house of the Lord! You are honorable men! Behave honorably!
The movie itself, Zhang Yimou was the director, and Zhang Yimou is famous for, you know, sort of a nuanced look at people and their motivations. You can't look at this movie and see much in the way of nuance.
Right.
You know,
evil Japanese, good China. Yeah.
Yeah. And people aren't blind to that. It reads like a piece of agitprop.
But it's popular in China, is it not?
Oh, it was very popular in China, yes. But in terms of getting its message out abroad, not so successful.
At the high end, in terms of the export of Chinese culture abroad, I mean, there are beautiful movies that do well in art houses in the United States. And then there at the other end, from mostly from Hong Kong and not the mainland, obviously there have been the Kung Fu movies for years. It's hard for me to reckon. Maybe I just don't have the vision to imagine it, even in this Chinese century. A huge Chinese pop culture industry that spreads across the world. Can you foresee that?
This is a pretty vibrant place. I can see it. I mean, the ball is really in the Chinese government's court. I mean, if they let their artists have a freer hand, if their filmmakers can take on controversial subjects, if they can feature stories about iconoclasts,
right?
You know, they want to create their own version of Avatar, right? But if they're going
right.
to create their version of Avatar, they need to create their version of The Searchers first. Then they need
right.
to create their own version of Little Big Man. You know, they need to create all the precedents to create the strong blockbuster that has appeal worldwide.
That's a good point.
So I really, you know, this is a vibrant, interesting, fast-growing, exciting place. And all the government has to do is take its hands off.
Well, and I'm sure 150 years ago, if you talk to British and French people, they'd say these Americans are never going to be able to compete culturally on a global scale, right?
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Exactly. I mean, this is a difficult country to underestimate.
Carlos Tejada, thank you very much.
Sure. Thanks for your time.
Carlos Tejada is China news editor for The Wall Street Journal. What do you think? Are Chinese TV shows and movies ever going to become staples of our cultural diets here in the United States? Tell us at studio360.org.
Y'all gonna learn Chinese. Y'all gonna learn Chinese.
Hey, hey.
Y'all gonna learn Chinese. When the pumps come out, y'all gonna speak Chinese.
Yeah.
Y'all gonna learn Chinese.
I know why.
Last month, thousands of mathematicians from all over the world arrived in Boston for the Joint Mathematics Meeting, the big annual global gathering of mathematicians. And in the exhibit hall, there was an art show.
This year we have 80 artists, about 120, 130 artworks, artists from all over the world. Well, art and math might seem different on the surface, but there are certainly similarities. I mean, both are about beauty and truth, I think.
In math, if you want to prove something really beautiful, you have to understand the structure. And the structure means that you understand the beauty of an object. And with that knowledge, you oftentimes can make a very, very important and deep proof.
So a lot of times, you know, I'm there, you know, trying to explain to other people why math is, like, really cool, really dynamic, really sort of like this engaging sort of topic. And, you know, people sort of give me that look like I'm like that crazy person screaming about the end times there on the corner of the street. You know what I mean? But, like, this is an example of, you know, you don't need, you know, a bunch of 4,000 level classes to see why this looks cool. This is innately beautiful in and of itself.
We've got a video of that art exhibit, and it really is cool and beautiful. That's at studio360.org. And while you're there, check out lots more stories from our ongoing series on science and creativity. Boom, ba, boom, ba. Coming up, boom, ba, boom, ba. The new movie Miss Bala is set in the middle of Mexico's drug war. But this isn't a conventional shoot-'em-up action film, and the director Gerardo Naranjo says that was very much his point.
In a Schwarzenegger film, you are seeing the ejaculatory force of the gun, just spitting bullets. We say, what if we turn around the camera and we see the effect of that, but not in a glorious way, in a very pathetic way.
That's ahead in Studio 360 from PRI and WNYC. Stay with us.
Studio 360 is supported by Scion. Scion, making vehicles for today's connected youth and offering over 150 accessories to choose from. Learn more at scion.com. Scion, what moves you?
This is Studio 360. I'm Kurt Anderson. Practically all the news we hear out of Mexico these days seems to be about the war between the drug cartels and the government. Something like 50,000 Mexicans have died since 2006, and there doesn't seem to be any end in sight. A new movie called Miss Bala is an artful, riveting, real-seeming depiction of that war. But this isn't a standard good guys, bad guys thriller. It's told through the eyes of an innocent bystander, a beauty pageant contestant who happens to be in the wrong place at the wrong time. She's kidnapped by a gang leader and has no choice but to become his accomplice. The movie's co-writer and director, Gerardo Naranjo, got the idea for his film from a real event in Mexico.
Well, basically, it's based on a picture that I saw where a beauty queen was arrested with some criminals. Later on, the beauty queen was released. She wasn't charged. What I wanted to say is, like, just in a country where the law and justice work in such mysterious ways, those two worlds can join together, the world of criminality and the world of the beauty queens, which had nothing, shouldn't have anything to do together. But, I mean, somehow in a country like Mexico, these things can start to happen.
Right. I mean, one of the terrifying parts for the character, the heroine, through whose eyes we see everything, is that there's nowhere to go, it seems, to kind of get out. I mean, she can't, I'm gonna leave these criminals who've kidnapped me and go to the good guys. It's impossible to tell who the good guys are, right?
Yeah, basically, I guess, based on what you say, which I agree completely, like, there is no social institution which will survive the power of the criminals. The movie has a theory that it's saying there is no good guys anymore. Even if you are good, there is no way you can try to rebel against this, like, power. Even the people with the most dignity, I think everybody's somehow
making peace with this horrible
exactly.
situation.
Yeah. Exactly.
The actress who plays Miss Bala, and by the way, I was confused. Wait, it's in Baja. Why isn't she Miss Baja? And then I realized Bala means bullet. So it's a pun, really.
Yeah, yeah. In English, it would be Miss Bullet.
Miss Bullet. If we'd have to have a state called Bullop or something to make the pun work, I guess. But Stephanie Sigmund is the actress, and she is just mesmerizing. I mean, there's... It's not a dialogue heavy movie, so it's a lot just watching her in the various nuances of terror that she is experiencing. and she does it wonderfully. How did you choose her and why?
It was important for me to find a person that will be that will have an inner strength, that will have a way to fight so many things that happened to her with certain dignity. So she as a woman will survive these things. And to me, that was one of the most important things, not to go into the melodrama Mexican soapy way where she will be just crying and she will be sobbing and just...
Like we see in the telenovelas every day and every night.
Exactly. I didn't want her to be asking God why God sent her this punishment. Like, I really wanted her to survive it with, you know, being like a strong person and somebody you can look up to.
Right.
And this was her first film and it was incredible, you know. I think a trained actor at times... I think they don't feel. They know a trick to look like they feel, but they don't truly feel it. I told her that she couldn't express herself through dialogue or not even through gesture. That I said, the only way you will be acting in the film will be through the eyes.
Yeah.
So try to, you know, find your way to
It's almost like a silent film in
yes.
that way, yeah? Let's listen to a clip. This is the moment when she, the heroine, Laura, is kidnapped by Lino, the drug gang boss. He says, it's okay, I'm going to help you, but I need you to do something for me. And in response, she says nothing, which makes it even more intense.
Está bien, Canelita. Yo te voy a ayudar. Pero también necesito que jales algo por mí. ¿Tú qué dices?
That is from the new Mexican movie Miss Bala, and you can watch the clip at studio360.org if you'd like. I'm talking with the film's director, Gerardo Naranjo. As probably a lot of the listeners know, in the last 6 years since Felipe Calderon has been president and the drug war has really amped up, maybe 50,000 people have been killed by the gangsters, by the authorities, in the war, mostly in the north and on the Pacific coast. As somebody who has lived there, who is Mexican, have you experienced the war, or is it all something that happens over there out of sight?
No, it's in Mexico City already. There is a city next to Mexico City called Cuernavaca, which is already like the paradise of the drug dealers. They have taken that city completely, and it doesn't go one day in Mexico City without one crime related to that. Like, they find a head or a body, and you know. But I think, you know, the biggest problem for me is that the society, I think we believe we are lucky or we are special, and we think, oh, it's happening to them. It won't happen to us because we're very special.
It's individual luck or individual effort. I'm going to be okay.
Oh, I'm rich and my house has a big fence and they won't get to me. I resist myself to believe that I'm lucky, and I think we have to start talking about the problem and, you know, try to find what can we do about it.
You've said that Mexican movies before Miss Bala that portrayed the drug gangsters show them as not so bad and as sort of Robin Hoods in a way. Given that your portrayal doesn't glorify them at all, doesn't sympathize with them, did you worry about how those guys would feel about your movie as you were making it?
Yeah, of course. We always feared that. And we tried to do the things in the best way we can. So when we shot the film, we said it was a romantic comedy and it was another name. It was called
Really?
Beautiful Maria. And we were just making a romantic comedy and they didn't feel attacked. And now, well, I hope when they see the movie, they'll feel that I'm not attacking them and or the government. Like, I don't think I'm attacking the government or the institutions. We all know they don't work. Like, we all know, you know, that they negotiate with the criminals. I think the movie attacks the most is society, and you say, what kind of society, of a dismembered society we have that we don't have any sense of fraternity?
How have we allowed this to happen?
Yes, exactly.
The character of the drug boss, Lino, who is played by Noé Hernández, is different from any kind of typical drug lord in the movies. He doesn't wear bling, and he's not loud and charismatic. He's this quiet, kind of clever, shrewd working man. Again, not good by any means, and terrifying and bad, but just kind of a regular guy, like a foreman on a construction site or something. I mean, how did you develop that character? Is that based on some real guy?
I think one of the origins of the film was precisely that. We had the suspicion that the criminals wouldn't be, as we see them in media, as these
Scarface guys.
Exactly. The heritage of Scarface, the Mexican way, you know? So the gold chains, the women surrounding them, the powerful cars, all this idea that it's an eternal party. And we really wanted to contradict that or just to give light to it. Are they that cool? And once we did our research, what we found is like these guys are pretty ignorant. And if they had any chance of doing anything different, they will do it. This book, Free Economics, put it well. The lifespan of a criminal in Mexico is very short. It's 4 years. It's a pathetic life, and they are not having the best time.
Well, and again, in this realm where we all know of the beheadings and these over-the-top, grotesque, psychopathic forms of death and atrocity, you see none of that here. I mean, it's violent and it's scary, but none of that Grand Guignol stuff happens.
Well, we try to precisely do an anti-action film, an anti, you know, Schwarzenegger movie, you know, whereas in a Schwarzenegger film you are seeing the ejaculatory force of the gun, just the spitting bullets. We say, what if we turn around the camera and we see the effect of that, but not in a glorious way, in a very pathetic way. And, you know, I mean, at the same time, there are certain things we cannot rebel to, you know. Even if we didn't show one image of drugs, and there is no allusion to drugs, people put the movie into narco culture.
Yeah.
You know? So
That's true. I hadn't even thought of that until now. There's no big piles of cocaine or anything. You don't see drugs.
No, I really didn't want it to, you know. I mean, I think you can infer that.
But all those sort of porn aspects of the super violence and the drugs, it's not there at all.
No, but somehow it is. I think.
It's just off camera.
Exactly.
And so, what's your take on the actual drug war situation in Mexico right now? Does it seem like it's in the middle, heading toward a conclusion?
I would love to think that we are in the middle of it because this doesn't look that it's going to finish ever. More because I think society and politicians, there is a tendency to say this is not happening. This is not really happening because Mexico is about happiness, it's about, you know, having a good life, and it's sunny, and the soil
is great. It's the 10th biggest economy in the world.
Exactly. So there is, I mean, certainly where I feel we are in almost in the middle of a fight, trying to say this is happening, this is an alarm. Somebody has to do something with it.
And with Ms. Bala, in addition to making a good story and an entertaining movie, are you really hope that it will have an effect on the way Mexicans who see it think about themselves and their country?
I think it did already. I think it did. Now we are trying to put it in the U.S. and we are trying to also make, you know, whoever in America is willing to take the film to start raising a discussion like what America has to do with this. You know, all the money.
We're not to blame.
Exactly. We didn't do anything. I mean, the money is coming from here. The weapons are coming from here. Certainly, the violence is getting here also. So, yeah, it will have to come from society. And I think that's the biggest challenge as Mexicans. I think we don't have this feeling of society, of a group of people living together. And I think that's the thing we have to start putting together.
So you've moved to New York, I understand. You live here now.
I live in Brooklyn. Yeah, for the time on, I talked to the producers and, you know, say after Ms. Bala, I like to stay away from Mexico for a bit.
Just to sort of clean your head of it, to meet new people? Why?
No. I guess I was afraid, not so much of me, but, you know, the people I have with me. So I really wanted to just, yeah, you know, I do feel there is a threat.
Really?
Yeah.
So you're sort of in a temporary self-exile?
Yeah, I guess so.
Interesting. Well, I hope nothing happens to you in Brooklyn, because that would be ironic.
No, I have the hoods with me.
Well, good luck with Miss Bala in the United States and the rest of the world. It's a great film.
Thank you. Thank you so much.
Miss Bala is playing in theaters now, and you can find out where at studio360.org. Jazz drummer Jack DeJohnette has an unbelievable discography, 200 albums and counting. He's recorded with pretty much all the jazz superheroes of the last half century, Miles Davis, John Coltrane, Sonny Rollins, Keith Jarrett, and the National Endowment for the Arts has just given him a Lifetime Achievement Award. DeJohnette may be the greatest living jazz drummer, but what he really wanted to do was play piano.
I found my thrill.
Fats Domino came out, you know, with a string of hits like Blueberry Hill, and he played this New Orleans piano. And so I started to learn how to play piano from the rock and roll tunes. I started working a lot around Chicago with piano trios, company singers, have my own quintet. So I got quite a name for myself as a pianist in Chicago.
Then he heard a record by the pianist Ahmad Jamal, a 1958 album called But Not For Me. It was Jamal's piano playing that drew him in, but what really entranced him was the drummer Vernell Fournier. He was using brushes.
You know, brushes, they're another form of stick, but it uses like metal wires and sort of a rod that pushes them out through a tubular cylinder, and they fan out that look like a broom, sort of like. If they open too wide, you won't get a very detailed sound. But if you pull them in a little bit, you can adjust them and make them thin so you can get more precise attack on them. And that's what Vernell did. On Music, 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 his brushwork is just smooth. He's from New Orleans, so, you know, he really had an impeccable touch on the instrument, a deep sense of swing and of use of time and space. You know, he wasn't flashy, but played with purpose. And it's so relaxed, although it's very fast, but it's smooth, sophisticated. You know, it's like painting, you know. So I ran out and got me a set of brushes. And this was before I had a set of drums. I discovered that if you take an album cover and play brushes on them, they made this nice, nice, high-pitched swish sound that you would get on a snare hit. So I started playing drums and practicing them every day, 3-4 hours a day, and then practicing the piano. And I'd go to sessions, the club called McKee Fitchers on Cottage Grove in Chicago. Of course, I was there every night to see Coltrane and Elvin and Jimmy Garrison. And one night, Elvin didn't return for the last set. The place was packed. So McKee says to John, he says, Hey, listen, let Jack DeJohnette play the last set. The place is packed and, you know, it's just getting late. And he's a good drummer. He plays the sessions. And Coltrane just nodded his head. He didn't say, who's this guy? I don't know. Can he play? I went up and played four tunes with Coltrane. And it hit me clearly like a bolt of lightning. Like, oh, drums is what I'm going to do. This is what I'm going to make my instrument. You know, the feeling of being able to create on any instrument is it's a hard to describe feeling of satisfaction and joy. I'll be 69 this year, but I find that my passion hasn't waned. If anything, it's got stronger. I feel like a kid.
Jack DeJohnette. He was just named a jazz master by the National Endowment for the Arts, and his new album is called Sound Travels. Is there some recording or book or movie that changed your life? Tell us about it at studio360.org. A couple of weeks ago, we announced the winner of our 420-character story contest. It was judged by Lou Beach, who invented the 420-character story on Facebook. Hundreds of you submitted stories to our site, and I was really knocked out by the great stuff that you submitted. And even though our official contest is done, I couldn't resist calling up a couple of more of you to have you read your work.
Hi, Kurt. This is John from Charlottesville, Virginia. The bent sign on the cliff's edge read, "Warning, no diving." We'd been ignoring it ever since we bent it. I dumped my bike with a dusty summer clank and I flung my t-shirt aside. The warning blurred. I was flying. The newspaper said it was 50 feet. I was falling. My arms flailed in vain to keep me upright. A white crash followed. Now, my desire to walk up there and straighten that sign sometimes overwhelms me.
My name is Judith Mary G. from New York City. Except for when a resident, generally from the dementia ward, became violent and/or busted loose, the atmosphere at the old folks' home remained tranquil as a cup of chamomile tea. It was such a contrast to the forlorn circus from which my guardian had been expelled after one too many failed stunts. The other aged exiles had committed crimes involving either fire or water. To Monkey King, that was amateur hour.
There are hundreds more great super short stories written by you and your fellow listeners posted at our website, and you can read them there. Thanks to everybody who submitted a story. And if you find yourself inspired, we're still collecting them at studio360.org. Coming up, the composer Eve Biglarian. She traveled all the way down the Mississippi River in a kayak, observing the middle of America as it rolled by, and writing music about what she saw and felt.
You, by getting on the river, are following a line, and you may not know the outcome of anything that's going to happen along the way of this journey, but you are going in a particular direction.
That's next in Studio 360 from PRI and WNYC. Stay with us.
Studio 360 is supported by Scion. Scion, making vehicles for today's connected youth and offering over 150 accessories to choose from. Learn more at scion.com. Scion, what moves you?
Do, 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 do
This is Studio 360. I'm Kurt Anderson. I've always fantasized about Huck Finn. Huck Finn-like journeys. That's why some friends and I spent weeks driving a very old school bus through Mexico when we were 18, and why the cross-country road trip is such an iconic American experience. Well, my guest today made the Huck Finn fantasy literal, launched a small boat down the Mississippi River, and let the adventure unfold. Eve Baglarian spent 4 months traveling from the headwaters in northern Minnesota down to the Gulf of Mexico. She made the trip mostly in a kayak, trading off for a bicycle on some stretches. Baglarian is not a professional traveler. She is a composer. Birdsong, spoken word, and digital instruments pop up regularly in her music. So on this river trip, she gathered all kinds of sounds and stories, and now she's turned that whole rich trove of material into an ambitious set of songs. It's called Brim, Songs from the River Project. She's been performing the piece this winter, and she is here now to perform some of it just for us. Eve Baglarian, welcome to Studio 360.
Thank you, Kurt. It's wonderful to be here.
So had you ever done anything remotely like this before taking on a musical creative project?
No. I mean, I did my share of cross-country trips and college days and all of that kind of thing. But no, the idea of sort of untethering myself from my ordinary life and heading down the river like this was really something new.
Were you a big kayaker, at least?
Not really.
Really? You know. How scary?
Well, the river actually teaches you how to kayak because it starts out as this little tiny stream.
Up in Itasca, is it?
That's right, Lake Itasca.
So to get started, and we'll talk some more, of course, I'd love to hear the first piece that you wrote after finishing this journey down the Mississippi. What's it called?
It's called I Am Really a Very Simple Person.
Well, we'll decide later whether that's actually literally true, but we'd love to hear the song.
Sounds good.
So,
that was the composer Yves Beglerian, along with Jeffrey Gavitt on vocals and Mary Rowell plucking a violin as well, performing I Am Really a Very Simple Person. It's from Brim, Songs from the River Project. How does that song arise out of the experience of traveling for months down the Mississippi?
Going down the river, I really didn't write any music at all. I sort of took it as a time to take things in rather than put things out. And someone had said to me, going down the river, had said, I am really a very simple person, of themselves. And I've come to understand that whenever anybody says, I am really a very
simple person.
They're lying. Totally.
Yeah.
We know this. Yeah. You know. And in fact, nobody really is a very simple person. So the idea with this piece is that it's not really a very simple piece, but it sort of seems like it is
right.
On first listen. So.
This song and the other songs we'll hear, would they be different if you'd written, if you'd gone to Paris for 4 months instead of kayaking down the Mississippi?
Entirely. And I wouldn't say that it's a literal A-B. You know, it's not like you can point and say, ooh, there is La Crosse, Wisconsin, exactly.
Right.
It wasn't like on any given day I did all this heroic, extreme sports activity.
Right.
It was maybe a 20 or 30-mile day, which, after you've been paddling for a bunch of days, is not really that many miles. So it wasn't stressful exercise. It was that kind of wonderful exercise where your mind can travel as you're traveling.
Right.
And I think it put me in a different kind of place in relation to the sources of my creativity.
I can totally imagine. Just, taking a long walk or something is where, or a shower, or any place other than life is where ideas seem to crop up. I would also think that for a composer and for you and your particular kind of music, that the sonic space of being in the middle of this gigantically wide river for so many hours and days must be a particular singular experience.
Yes, absolutely. And the river flows a particular way. Now, it flows a really complicated way because it's the Mississippi River,
right.
And the floodplain is 100 miles wide or whatever.
And it changes over. It's not the same one that Huck and Jim
exactly.
Went up.
Exactly. Yeah, and not only because of the Army Corps of Engineers. The river itself changes its mind regularly.
Yeah.
But there is this sense that there is a line, and you, by getting on the river, are following a line, and you may not know the outcome of anything that's going to happen along the way of this journey, but you are going in a particular direction, and I think that's the Huck Finn, that's what is in Huck Finn,
right.
Is that sense of both open-endedness and there's an outcome that we're heading towards.
Like, say, life. You must have met dozens and dozens and dozens of people you'd never known and will never see again. Were there any particularly fascinating ones?
Well, one that stands out is this riverboat captain that I met.
No, there aren't any riverboat captains anymore.
For real. He was straight out of Twain. It was amazing. At a boat launch just north of Memphis, a guy named David Greer, who's a poet and a writer as well as a riverboat captain, and who grew up in Mississippi. And so he gave me all these Eudora Welty stories, mapped them to the towns where they're set, and sent me, it was basically a literary map of Mississippi.
And you just ran into this guy?
Yeah, totally amazing. But In and Out of the Game is actually dedicated to a guy named Paul that I met in Cape Girardeau. And Paul was a 80-year-old man, very sort of friendly and warm, and confessed to me that he was planning to commit suicide at the same time that he was this very jaunty and engaged guy. And so I wrote this piece in a way to talk him out of not doing it. Of course, I haven't met him again, but that was sort of my thought to...
How, when you meet a stranger on in southern Missouri, does it come to be that he confesses this intent?
I think the role of a traveler is to be a stranger in a place and to be someone that people can talk to and confess to. And
so existential one-night stands, I guess.
Yeah. It happened over and over again that I would end up having these really intense conversations, especially with older people. And I really feel that role of being the stranger you know, it has an ancient lineage that has a very important role to play, especially in a small town where everybody knows everybody's business, you know? And I felt really lucky to find myself in that position of being the stranger.
And now that we've heard that amazing genesis story of the song In and Out of the Game, why don't you have your trombonists perform it for us?
That'd be great.
Eve Baglarian's In and Out of the Game, performed by the trombone quartet Guidonian Hand, who are Jen Baker, Mark Brashinsky, William Lang, and James Rogers. Eve Baglarian, thank you very much.
Thank you so much, Kurt.
You can see a video of Eve Baglarian performing live for us at studio360.org. And that's it for this week's show. Thanks so much for listening, and I hope you'll listen again next time. Studio 360 is a production of WNYC and PRI, Public Radio International. Our production team includes
Vital Malad,
David Krasnow,
Michelle Siegel,
Derek John,
Jenny Lawton,
Josh Rogerson,
Alana Harper,
Rebecca Lee Douglas,
Thomas Seeley,
Krista Ripple.
Our story about art by mathematicians was produced by Sarah Reynolds. Special thanks this week to Jocelyn Ford and, as always, to WNYC's Chris Bannon. Our theme music is by David Van Tegel.
Studio 360 is supported by Scion. Scion, making vehicles for today's connected youth and offering over 150 accessories to choose from. Learn more at scion.com. Scion, what moves you? And by Ken and Lucy Lehman, who believe that winning workplaces respect, reward, and invest in their employees. By the National Endowment for the Arts, which believes that a great nation deserves great art. Studio 360's series on creativity and science is supported in part by the Alfred P. Sloan Foundation, enhancing public understanding of science and technology in the modern world. More information is online at sloan.org.
PRI, Public Radio International.
Next time in Studio 360, I'll talk to comedian Eugene Mirman about his career options, just in case this show business thing doesn't work out.
I would make a terrible spy, being openly Russian.
That's next time in Studio 360 from PRI and WNYC.
You've been listening to Studio 360 with Kurt Anderson from Public Radio International and WNYC. You can find out more about this episode, access our entire program archive, and leave us a comment at studio360.org.